This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
You know, Patrick, we're coming around the 12th anniversary of me being here at this radio station. I don't know. When are we going to have a good show, man?
Sorry. 12 years too many.
Oh, geez. The long funeral dirge. Hi there, kids. It's Matt. Matt and Patrick. Yeah, 12 years. God. I mean, I really tell you what, when it comes down to it, pound for pound, blackmail works. I think that's the lesson we've all learned here. You don't want me to show those photos, do you, Patrick? Do you? yes, indeed. Compliance. That's what I always look for. Good to have you with us here today. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Running in, I believe, is it 58A now? Give you an idea how much these districts changed from the redistricting changed the districts. This is the district that has got Northfield and kind of goes out to a little bit of New Prague. It's held currently by a Democrat. It's changed quite a bit, but it's held currently by a Democrat. But it is it went from, I think it was like 20A, now it's 58A. Tell you, hello, Minneapolis, St. Paul, you've grown. Anyway, we're going to talk to, coming up here, Democrat of the Day, Christy Purcell is going to be running for that seat. That seat's open because the current Democrat has decided not to run again, and that's a seat we need to hold. We're going to get on to that here at 4:35. Cooligan stops by with the fine folks at the Minnesota Reformer. We'll get to that here in a little bit. But I want to start off, of course, programming here brought to you in part by our good friend Todd Colin. Now, Todd, as the story goes, he moved to Spain. Can't visit our sponsors, wants to sponsor the station, so he does. Now, if you'd like to do this, 952-946-8885, 952-946-8885 is the phone number. And you just, you know, you find out how you can do that yourself as well. You can also, by the way, support the station by becoming a member. Go to AM950 Radio on that. You can find out more there. Now, Todd wanted us to mention, now he is, if you follow Todd Colin, and I encourage you to do that either on Twitter or Facebook, Todd has been really big, like a lot of Europeans, on backing up Ukraine here. And he is working really hard. Now, we talked yesterday. Todd he's been booking Airbnbs in Ukraine that he's not going to go to, but basically making sure that the people there are getting some money. And we talked about the one woman that got back in touch with him saying that's going to go pay for the staff that they have there, the people that work for them, as well as also that's money that's going to go directly to the Ukrainian Defense Forces, which is phenomenal. And I'll get to that here in a quick second. But there's another organization here, and I posted about this on the Facebook Twitter feed. It's an organization called Lifeline Ukraine. Now this is it's mental health counseling, and obviously something that in Ukraine is going to be very serious. There's an individual over there, Paul Nyland, who is running this in Ukraine. He's been there for a while. He needs your help. So if you can help him out in any way, make a donation to help that out, by all means, please do, because the Ukrainians, I'm amazed more and more. You know, Patrick, how you and I have talked a few times about how amazing the Ukrainian Air Force is. You remember that ship that went out to that island and asked them to surrender, and they had a less than appropriate, I can't say it because the FCC rules, their response to the Russians on that?
Yep. Like,
we sank that, or they sank that. I mean, I want to call it we, but we can't. The Ukrainians sank that ship. They found it and they dropped it. So a salute to the Ukrainian Navy out there. Hello, not exactly. Did Putin not do any research on these guys? It seems like they thought that this was going to be like walking to Wisconsin. It's not once. It's, as the great line happened in Stripes, I got my ass kicked in Wisconsin once.
Well, if we go to Patrick's foreign policy corner, I'm such an expert.
But, Jesus. All right, go ahead.
But, you know, my impression was, you know, they were going to welcome the Russians with the open arms that they did
in
Crimea and some of those eastern provinces. And I don't think he realized Kyiv is not Crimea.
No, it's not. And most of Russia is not Crimea. Most of Ukraine is not Crimea. And let's also make sure we understand the Crimean Peninsula, half the people there didn't want to go with Russia. That was only a small percentage of the people wanted to go there. And the same thing with those two, those two border areas of Ukraine, which they've, gobbled up as well. Maybe we should ask a Russian general. Ooh, too soon? Sorry. You got the Russian generals dropping left and right. Hey, maybe it's just your military sucks, Russia. Yeah. If not for the fact that you can threaten people with nuclear bombs, no one would be afraid of you. As a matter of fact, if I'm Russia right now, the real loser is you, because you know who's paying attention to this? The Chinese. And trust me, as much as you are desperate to keep them your buddy right now on the world stage because they're about the only buddy you got, the Chinese are watching how poorly your military is doing against the Ukrainians and saying, hey, if you want Siberia, we can have that in probably 3 hours. Because I can tell you right now, the Chinese military is not the Russian military. Once again, your incompetence is magnificent, Russia. It is there. President of the United States came on out, and along with a lot of Democrats and Republicans, a lot of people coming together saying we're not going to fund the Russian war. So they have stopped all purchasing of any Russian oil in the United States, which is definitely going to hit us. We're going to see gas prices rise. We're going to see this is going to have an impact. And it's the right decision because, yeah, you can't, I mean, as much as, it's going to hurt at the pocketbook, the reality is that's money that's going to slaughter innocent Ukrainians. God, the stories, I'm tearing up at night reading the stories of people who are, I was trying to bring food to this needy senior center, and as I drove up to it, the Russians opened fire and killed three people in the car. It's stuff like this that is just, it's disturbing. It's just disturbing, and that's what the Russians are doing. They're slaughtering the Ukrainians. And frankly, it is unacceptable 1,000 ways from Sunday. I agree wholeheartedly with it. Doesn't mean it's not going to hurt. But I want to take a moment here, because if you're like me, today your social media somewhat imploded with all these far-right people screaming about Biden oil, gas prices, Biden, gas prices, Biden. That's what it was, right? If you're like me, I mean, mine exploded. Now, first of all, note to yourself. Even though the image associated with the account might look like some suburban woman who says, I've got kids and I'm a proud mama, that sort of thing. If the name is Joan 695-9943-22965, that's not a real account. That's not a real account. That's a fake account. If it's got a string of numbers next to the name, that's a fake account. It may look like it's a real account, but take a look. I mean, if it's got, say, 200 or less followers, and it basically is all it is screaming at walls but tries to, it's like, I'm a hockey mom, and I love romantic comedies, but the entire timeline is just Biden. It's a troll. So I've had to deal with my fair share of trolls today, which is, mwah. Yeah. Ooh, you have more to say? What's that? The block button? Bye. I have determined within 3 or 4 words of your post that you are someone who is not worth listening to. So I will block you. And my life is better for it. Ta-da! Because you see, this is the modern Republican mentality. They want to kick open the door of your house, go to the bathroom in the middle of the floor of your living room, point to it with a smile on their face and say, you have to like it. And the reality is, no, I don't. I'm going to take you, put my foot firmly up your backside, throw you out of my house, and say goodbye. And lock the door. And scene. That's how you do it. Now, I'll explain each one of these. But what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to give you your bullet point response to the Biden gas, gas Biden, oil Biden, gas Biden, oil, oil Biden, gas. I'm going to give it to you. Here you go. Here's your three quick, easy, painless. All right. The reason why gas prices are skyrocketing is 1, Russia invaded Ukraine. 2, Donald Trump cut oil production by 10% in April of 2020. He did. Three, oil and gas companies have 9,000 leases they could start drilling on today, and they purposely aren't. And scene. That's all you have to say. And you might get them. And here's the other part of this. So you'll put that out there. And like I said, Russia invaded Ukraine. Donald Trump encouraged OPEC to cut 10% of oil production in the world. And that was April of 2020. And oil and gas companies have 9,000 leases they're not using. Now, without a doubt, you're going to get, that's not right. Biden, that's not right. All right, so let's run through each one of these, okay? Because you might, if you do have one of the deranged, drooling lunatics that's screaming at you on social media is actually a loved family member that you don't want to necessarily alienate, but you want to try to educate, well, here's how you do it. First of all, I think the Russia-Ukraine war is self-explanatory. I mean, we can't, you know, is he saying that we should be giving money to a bloodthirsty despot? I don't think so. You know, if they're going to be upset about, I don't care. Why are we caring about Ukraine? Just that's like so Christian. That's all I want you to say is so Christian. And I think we're done talking if this is really your point of view. Now, let's get to the other two little gems. Indeed, Donald Trump cut oil production. He convinced the OPEC and all the Saudis and all this to cut oil production by 10% in April of 2020. Now, the story that they put out, the story was that, well, American oil producers are having a hard time, so we're going to, this is a way to help them out. Okay, that's a lie, because oil companies in this country have not had a bad day in 50 years. I mean, they really have not. Not in since the oil crisis of the 70s, the early 70s, have they had any problems. They're flush with cash. And when they say they're having a problem with oil and gas industry, what they're really saying is, well, as opposed to making $1.20 per share, they're only going to make 85 cents per share. Now, they're still making a massive profit, but just not the obscene profit they want to make. So that's, we're living check to check. That's where that crap comes from. All right. And this is the argument they made, but that's a false argument. The reality is that this was by design. This is what the Republicans do. And the Republicans do this stuff all the time. It's like when in the summer, when all of a sudden gas prices go up, because they always do. Gas prices always go up in the summer. When it's a Republican president, nothing. Just maybe it's like, boy, gas prices are a lot high. Now let's check the weather. You know, that's it. When it's a Democrat, it's, why is this Democrat killing grandma? You know, that's kind of the mentality, because that's how the media, the Republicans want it. The oil, gas, and coal industry are all in the pocket of the Republican Party, or the Republican Party is in the pocket of them. And this is the news media, which is kind of worthless. This is how they report things. They don't ever, when a Republican is in office and gas prices are high, it's always, oh my God, nothing to see here. When it's a Democrat, it's, you know, who are you ready to pay your one kidney for more gas? That's kind of the way they do it. So this is by design. Trump did this, and Trump's not smart enough to do this. The Republican Party coordinated this with the oil and gas industry under this guise. They basically said, well, here's the deal. It's April of 2020. We cut 10% of world production now. The gas prices are going to start going up beginning of next year, which they did. Now, if it's a Republican president at that point, we'll just say this. Well, hey, we need to open up every bit of pristine wilderness in America and drill, 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 baby, drill. That's what their argument would be. If the Democrat won, then all of a sudden it became, oh, look at what happened. A Democrat becomes president. Gas prices skyrocket. Now, if you think for one second that this wasn't coordinated, let me ask you something. Do you honestly think coast to coast, all those little vandalism stickers that the Republicans have putting on gas pumps across the country, which says Biden pointing and saying, I did this? Do you think that all of a sudden that was independently thought up, that across the country in all 50 states and all the different markets in this country, that someone sat down and was like, hey, let's come up with this idea for a Biden sticker we'll put on gas pumps? No. This was coordinated. It was by design. And they started putting those stickers up when? The day after Biden became president. That's when. It was all coordinated. So Trump did this not because Trump cut oil production. Trump did that. And that's why I won the gas prices are up. Now, if you're looking, if someone comes back to you and says, that's not true, go find the story. I think it's April 12, 2020, New York Times, Trump oil prices. You'll find it. Ding. Post that to them and expect them not to respond because I don't really have a response for this. Tell you what I'll do. I'm going to take a break. When I come back, I'll get Mike in Columbia Heights on the phone, and then I'll come back and I'll talk about the leases because that's something also that it, the gas and oil industry is getting a really big pass on that. And the reality is they are specifically and purposely jacking up their prices by not drilling for the oil and gas they could right now. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show on your Tuesday. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Mike is in Columbia Heights, been kind enough to hold. Welcome on in, Mike.
Matt, ahoo.
Ahoo, man.
Hey, back when they started the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, I listened to Jason Lewis and Sean Hannity talking about how gas was going to bottom out probably at about $5 a gallon. And Paul Wellstone introduced a bill in the Senate that put a surtax on excessive oil companies' profits. And boom, right away the price of gas came down and got more reasonable and was reasonable up until about this time right now. So, Amy Klobuchar, let's get a bill going through the Senate that charges a search tax on excessive oil company profits.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it. And thank you very much for the phone call. No, he's exactly right. Look, when Trump in 2020 negotiated with NATO for them to cut oil production by 10%, he and all the Republicans said the same thing. They all said it. It's like when people said, well, this is going to raise up gas prices. Gas will be so cheap. Gas is not going to grow up at all. This is not going to raise gas prices at all. Now, I am not the smartest business major that ever came out of William Penn University, but I do know this. If you cut supply, but demand is still there, you're not going to be dropping prices. All right? That's generally not how it works. But that was their whole argument because it was a lie. They knew when they cut gas production, and this was Trump. Trump did this. When he encouraged everyone to cut gas production by 10%, they knew the price would skyrocket. So the two trade-offs were, one, basically start going out through every bit of natural pristine land we have in this country, or two, the Democrat wins and basically, oh, well, it's Joe Biden. And like I said, those Joe Biden stickers showed up the day after he took office. They showed up. That was nationwide. It was a coordinated thing. And it still is today. And that's why all these trolls are coming out here. So once again, problem one, when you're either a troll or your deranged Trump uncle comes after you. One, Ukraine-Russia war. Boom. Two, Trump actually cut oil production by 10% in April of 2020. Boom. And if he needs that story, it's the New York Times, April 12th, I believe it is, 2020. You can find that story. Number three is the leases. There already are 9,000 oil and gas leases in the United States of America ready to go. Many of them have already gone through the environmental review, which means the only thing that has to happen is the oil and gas company has to drive out there and start drilling. More oil, more gas. They could conceivably drill 40 or 50 new wells a year. And it would take, 40, 50? Let's do 50. It's time for Matt's Math Corner. I probably shouldn't know this off the top of my head. 9,000 divided by 50 equals, it would take 180 years. It would take 180 years for the oil and gas industry to burn through all the permits they currently have to drill if they drilled 50 new wells a year. They've got more than, and it's not like, oh, we don't know if there's oil or gas there. No, we know there's oil or gas there. That's why they want the permits. That's why they wanted them. They bought them. The oil and gas is there. They themselves have come on out and said, we will not drill. It's twofold. One, it creates the ability for them to say, well, we need more drilling areas out there. So they don't want to drill in those areas because they don't want that extra gas to get to the market so that they can go on out there and convince far-right loon balls to basically give over all the pristine wilderness for drilling. That's part of it. But the other part of it is just plain greed. They have purposely said, we want to have our return on investment here. So if we start drilling, we're actually going to make less money. So that's the, and really, if you want to know the truth, is Ukraine-Russia war, that's there. Trump cut production by 10%, that's there. The first thing you look at is like, okay, why are you basically asking for more permits if you got 9,000 of them and you're not even touching them? Many of them ready to go. All they have to do is drive out there and start drilling. No interest, because they don't want that oil on the market and they want to basically be able to strong arm to get all the other permits available until they are ready. And that's the crime of this whole thing. That's the real crime of this. Today, I actually had someone, possibly the stupidest argument they could make, in one tweet, starts off by saying, Matt, how dare you? Don't you understand the cost of digging and setting up the rig and the personnel? These are big cost things that you are not factoring in. We need to give them more permits. What? So wait a minute here. Your argument against them using the current permits is that it's going to be too pricey, too costly, it's not something that they can do. But then in turn, we should give them more permits for them to sit on and not use, because why again? I'm not quite sure about that. Needless to say, the oil and they're on record basically saying this is the reason why they're not drilling when they have the permits already. They're saying that because they don't want the prices to go down. 9,000. If they started, once again, if they did 50 new wells a year, which would produce a tremendous amount of oil and gas, if they did 50 new drills a year, it would take them 180 years to use up all the permits that they currently have. This isn't Joe Biden. It's not. And by the way, there are plenty of places where you can find the information on them jacking up the prices by not using the permits out there. I think I got someone that sent one of the things here, and maybe I'll retweet that really quick. And I don't want to retweet the one where he swore. Let's see here. Do I want then? Here's a back for you, dumb dumb. Yes, here we go. I'll retweet that one. There you go. And yeah, I won't retweet the other ones which have the swear words. But there you go. There you have the information. So once again, you go up online, Trollville, deranged Trump uncle, Biden oil, oil, Biden, Biden oil, Biden, Biden oil. Three bullet points. One, the real cause of the oil prices rising, gas prices rising. One, Russia invaded Ukraine. Two, Trump cut oil production by 10% in April of 2020. And three, the oil and gas industry have 9,000 leases they are refusing to use because they're trying to keep gas prices high. And scene. And like I said, I just gave you all the rest of the information so that they come back to you and they say, oh, where did you get this from? You know, the New York Times article, April 12th, 2020, has the Trump stuff. I just posted something from Joseph Eldon in regards to the oil and gas companies here. The reality is I think you just go to the BBC for the stuff on the Ukraine. I don't know there, but there you go. It's not Biden. Biden's doing the right thing by cutting off Russian oil. But the reality is that maybe it is time for us to start looking into the profit margins of these oil and gas companies, because they're not exactly living check to check. And that whole deal that Trump did where he cut production by 10%, that's a good chunk of why our gas prices are high. And once again, that was done by design. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Well, we could at least go with green energy. The hell with those guys then. We'll take a break. Come on back. Democrat of the day when we do return. Christy Purcell. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. So when the redistricting maps came on out, one of the things we said is, well, there's still quite a few pretty much safe DFL districts in the metro area. As a matter of fact, it really comes down to about 10 districts outside of the metro core. If the DFL can hold those districts, Rochester, Duluth, Moorhead, places like that, well, they're going to win, and they're going to hold the majority because just that's the way the redistricting happened. Currently, there is a district just south of us. It's this one, of all the numbers that changed, this one, it was 20B. It is now 58A. Todd Lippert is the current representative. He announced that he is not going to run again. And the new 58A, we need to keep in the DFL corner. This is a must win for us, which I'm going to say it now. I'm going to say it later. You need to get out of your comfort zone and get down there and door knock and help 58A stay in the DFL's in their roundhouse there. All right. Christy Purcell is kind enough to join us right now. She is the candidate for 58A. She's kind enough to talk about her upcoming race. Christy, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Oh, thank you so much, Matt. I appreciate being the Dem of the day. I'm honored.
It's not an official title. No, I'm glad you're on, because the whole point of this segment is, I mean, it's nice when I talk to I live in Hopkins. My district is represented by Cheryl Joachim. She's going to win. She's going. I mean, I can pretty much guarantee you she's going to win that seat again. It's, you know, there, and we don't take it lightly, but that's a pretty strong DFL district. What my goal here is to get people out of their safe districts and get them into these other districts so they can help out. And your district down there, I mean, how much did it change in the redistricting? I think you actually had a pretty substantial change, right?
Yes. Yeah, so the geography of the district changed pretty significantly, but because of the way Minnesota redistricts with the legislative panel, the makeup of the district is still pretty purple. Mm-hmm. So we, as you said, went from 20B to 58A. So maybe one of the biggest number swings, as they do that circular numbering.
I think it is. I think it actually is the biggest one. I can't think of another one that went that much.
Yes. So that was surprising when those new maps came out. But really, it's some similar communities of the district from 20B. So I live in the town of Northfield, and then some of the smaller communities and rural spaces to the west of Northfield. The district used to expand further west, and now it goes kind of north and then a little bit west. So the community of New Prague, for example, is newly into this district now. So that's a bigger shift, but it seems like looking at the numbers, it's a similarly very purple district. It's not, it's not a for sure in the DFL column by any means.
But it also is, and I think a lot of people, when you describe the district, would be surprised. Like, the DFL are down there. Yeah, there are some DFL strongholds, including the town you live in. Northfield has become more and more DFL, and I know that you got the colleges down there, but it's become more part of the metro. I mean, Northfield, it's as hard as it is for me to believe, is there's a lot of people that live there and travel up into the cities. I mean, it is changing as far as the dynamic goes, and with that change comes a more DFL strength. Once again, not the whole district, but definitely Northfield has become more and more DFL.
Yep. Yes, and we had for, I can't remember how many terms, David Bly won the seat in the House for many consecutive terms, and he stepped down two cycles ago, and then our current representative, Todd Lippert, who was previously a pastor at the UCC church here, he threw his hat in the ring, and he's won successfully the last two rounds. But certainly not a seat any of us take for granted. It, as I mentioned, is very purple. It does help to have two liberal arts colleges in town. There's about 5,000 students. Not all of them vote in the district. A lot of them do absentee ballots for their home districts as well. But I do think, I love surprising people when they learn a little bit more about our district or my community, because we are told, especially in a national level, that rural spaces are a monolith. Rural spaces should just be ceded to the GOP. And I have found that absolutely untrue.
Yes.
And I hope to continue to be able to paint a more nuanced story of what rural Minnesota in particular looks like.
I get furious when I hear DFLers talk about, oh, we need to give up on the districts. And no, you fight in every district, every single district. And you go on out there, because, I mean, the DFL message is a winning message. And I don't care if you're in the heart of the city or you're out in rural Minnesota. The DFL is the district, is the party that's trying to help these districts. And that's just the reality. And yes, you have a different district than the metro area ones, but it doesn't mean those DFL principles don't apply and apply strong to your district.
Exactly. And I think my family, my spouse was a farmer for many years, and there's really incredible strength and connections within the farming community in this area. And I believe we have to really make sure to get that F back in the DFL. Of course, we need to make sure that L is in there as well. But I think that has been historically the strength in Minnesota, is to be able to marry farmer interest, labor interest, and the Democratic Party all together. And I hope that my district can be an example of where that can work and be a shining example for other spaces not to just give up and cede this territory.
Christy Purcell, kind enough to join us, District 58A. Let's take some time right now. Why don't you introduce yourself a little bit to everyone out there? Who exactly is Christy Purcell?
Thank you. We just jumped right into it. So my name is Christy Purcell, and I currently live in Northfield, Minnesota. I grew up in Rochester and went to college in Northfield, and then lived many places around the state, around the country, and eventually then kind of boomeranged, found myself back here in Northfield. My family has been here 7 years now. I am a parent. I have two elementary school age children, ages 7 and 9. I've been an environmental and nonprofit professional for most of my working life. And currently I'm executive director of a clean water nonprofit with our office here in Northfield, formerly known as the Cannon River Watershed Partnership. Last year we changed our name to Clean River Partners. So that's my current place I hang my hat.
Wow. No, that's going to resonate. There's something nice there. Northfield, it's interesting. Okay, so Northfield, when I was a kid, was a little like Wall Drug to a point. It's like, oh, well, they got the Jesse James stuff there. And not many other people. There was, and of course, St. Olaf, the colleges there and this stuff. So you get you had that, but it was kind of one of those things where it was kind of one off. I was down in Northfield about 7-8 years ago, and I was like, what? This is cute. It's nice. And in Northfield, and it's not, I mean, I'm not going to talk about, you know, some towns it's hard to go in there because you see the remnants and the ghosts of the past.
Oh,
what you don't
it's
see,
heartbreaking.
You go to Northfield, you don't see that. Talk about that a little bit, because that has been, that's the positive growth you want to see in a small town community.
That's right. We are downtown through generations of people really caring, really looking out for, have made sure that our downtown continues to be a vibrant and viable place for people to do business. My office is downtown, but as well as for people to come visit. So it's next to the beautiful Cannon River, and our downtown street there, there's all kinds of different restaurants and different shops. It's really kind of a destination for folks to day trip. So I heard you plugging, you know, come on down and do door knocks. We will have plenty of opportunities to do that. And then you can get a delicious meal or a craft beverage. We have 3 different craft breweries in the area, 2 in Northfield proper, 1 just south in Dundas. There's a craft cidery just outside of town in the country on a farm where they grow the apples. It's really it's really quite a place. And when my friends and family come down from Minneapolis and St. Paul, they're always like, this is way closer than I thought it was going to be. And I always don't tell. it's a little hidden gem. Come and visit. Come and check it out. But I think Northfield can really be an example for small to mid-sized towns. We have 20,000 population, but that includes 5,000 college students. So it's really a special place, a wonderful place to raise a family, for sure. That's one of the reasons why I came back here.
Well, it is cute, and you're not going to stop the people from going down there. It is absolutely adorable down there. The district is interesting because you do have New Prague on the west side. You have Northfield on the east side. But you do have a lot of farm territory in there. Let's talk about some of the farmers' issues here that are going to be important for you to champion if you get up into St. Paul here.
Yeah. So, luckily, I feel really grateful. My current house rep, Todd Lippert, has really been a champion for farmers and making sure that at the state level, we're able to support farmers doing the right thing for clean water, for climate, for soil health. And that's a way that I've been able to plug in to what is happening at the state legislature is through his work. And so it's my number one priority to be able to continue that work and to be a champion for the small to mid-sized farms. And especially we have so many farmers and people, you know, growers in the rural space who are truly leading as far as their environmental footprint, looking at how they can mitigate climate change. So I think that has been really, really inspiring to me. I have learned a lot from these farmers who are instituting cover crops so that they'd never have any bare soil. Because the moment you have bare soil and there's snow melt or there's a hard rain, your topsoil is in Lake Pepin. And if not Lake Pepin, down in the Gulf of Mexico. And so keeping that soil there for the environmental benefits, for the climate benefits, and for the profitability of our farmers. We want them to stay here. If the farmers can't make it on the land, who is going to come in and buy up the land, and what kind of an ethic are they going to have? I don't know. I don't want to know. I want to keep our farmers right here doing the thing that they know how to do, and they know how to do it well, and make sure that we're supporting them when they do the right thing and lead the way.
I know broadband's going to be an issue here, especially, I mean, there's a lot of places, especially out in the far western part of the state, northern part of the state, where it's hardly non-existent. What is the broadband situation right now in 58A? Is it there, or is there still a lot of line to be laid here?
Yeah, it's pretty spotty. Okay. It really depends. I mean, even in the town of Northfield, it kind of depends on what part of town or where that fiber has been laid or not. So it's pretty patchy. I know that there's a mobile home park where they do not have access to high-speed internet, although then there's a business right next to them which does have it. So there's definitely some discrepancies and some is just some dumb luck, and some seems a little more intentional, you know, not serving the lower income neighborhoods, potentially.
Well, I mean, and that's the problem here, is that that's exactly what it is. I mean, it reminds me when I was a kid, and I'm dating myself a little bit, when cable television came in. And where you got it was only in wealthy, wealy communities. And it wasn't until it got out that it all of a sudden became the thing that it was. But it was one of those things where wealthy people are like, I'm watching cable tonight. And you're like, oh, I don't have that. You can't have that. I mean, you can't have that mentality. This isn't just a luxury item anymore. Considering the nature of schools, healthcare, business, you gotta have this. And so you can't have this mentality of, well, we're going to go into the one or two neighborhoods where there might be some middle, upper class people, and that's it. You have to have a much more, you know, widespread plan. And it's disheartening to hear that, you know, even in districts which are close to the metro, there still is such spotty service down there.
And I think it really was laid bare when we went to remote learning 2 school years ago.
Yeah.
And then it is quite obvious in the school district and some of our local nonprofits just absolutely hit the pavement. We're going door to door to provide iPads to students and to figure out, you know, hotspots to make sure that students had access to school, because that's how they were accessing school. So I think that issue is definitely more top of mind for folks in the area than it was 3-4 years ago. It was just very, very obvious that we have a ways to go to fix that.
farmers' margins are always an interesting discussion point here. I mean, and you kind of talked a little bit about it. You know, you got the cidery, which sounds fantastic, by the way, cidery and stuff like this. You get, are you seeing the farms change that much down in that area where you're getting much more like farmers' market farmers where they're bringing in produce and stuff like that? When a farmers' market is there, you're turning it into kind of organics and kind of specialized business. Is it changing or is it still pretty much bread and butter farming down there?
Yes, that's a great question. The type of farming my spouse was doing, we were doing kind of the small scale, organic. We had a cut flower operation, so very specialty crop. And one reason why we ended up here is because there is quite an extensive network of people doing that sort of thing. Farmers markets, community supported agriculture, selling locally to the school district and the colleges and, you know, restaurants in Minneapolis, the local food thing. Mm-hmm. And that was what I knew coming in 7 years ago when I moved to the district, and having the privilege to work at Clean River Partners and being able to work with conventional farmers, they are still here. They're still such an important part of our community. And there's a lot of row crop agriculture that happens here, but there are still some grazing that happens as well, some animal agriculture on mm-hmm. this middle and larger scale. And it's been just so wonderful for me because my, growing up in the city and having more of this sort of specialty crop market experience, it's been wonderful to have the blinders taken off and being able to see all the different kinds of farmers, and just even driving around to be able to see the different types of agriculture. People who are leaving stubble on their acreage, which sometimes gets called trash, but we call it armor. Mm-hmm. It's protecting that soil. Those roots are staying in the ground. It's keeping it from blowing away or from drying up too quickly. And so we really have a wide variety of different types of farming operations. And I think what's been the hardest, and this is across the board for all the farmers I've interacted with, there's questions around healthcare. If someone does not have an off-farm job, how do they get affordable healthcare?
Yeah.
There's a question about, right, just profitability and margins. And so even if people might want to work on their farm, there's so much uncertainty and there's so many things that are tied to other pieces that they feel like they have to go off farm and get a 9-to-5 job someplace or work hourly just to have access to some of those pieces. And so something like, you know, Minnesota Care for All or something like that is not just a progressive Twin Cities issue. That really impacts the choices that farmers and rural people are making too.
This is the reason why she's fantastic. That's exactly what it is you just took something that gets labeled by Republicans as one of those liberal things from the Metro,
yep.
and you just took it and Minnesota Care and apply it to all the farmers. All of a sudden you've got a fantastic idea that gets the farmers there. I mean, you talk about the specialty farms. You got the benefit of Minneapolis, St. Paul, so you get a premium price mm-hmm. for your product yep. that's here. You can change these things out, and then you basically don't have to have people. They can still be farmers, and they don't have to be three other jobs while they do it. It's fantastic. I do want to mention, I'm going to mention this real quick here. I don't think we have to question your environmental chops here. The DFL Environmental Caucus gave you the approval there. I will also say that you got a nice endorsement from Representative Todd Lippert for this yeah. seat for 58A. So this is obviously, he's kind of passing on the torch to you. You're a fantastic candidate, and to everyone out there that's listening, you've got to get down there. Well, first of all, a cidery. I think we can all agree that we all need to go to that.
But, and a couple breweries.
And a couple breweries. It's right next to the metro area. It's just south of town here. This is not a far drive. You can get down there on a weekend, door knock, go out and have some great food, help her in the district. You can also make a donation. Christy, if people want to get in touch with your campaign to help out, what's the website for them to get in touch with you?
Sure. It's ChristyPurcell.com. And of course, there's many ways to spell both of those names. So it's Christy with a K and then ending with an I and Purcell with an S. But if you Google it, you should land on it.
I will link to it on social media. Go to Twitter, Facebook. I'll be all linked to it a little bit later on. Christy, all my best. We need you in St. Paul. And I'm going to be excited when you get in there next session. So thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Oh, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And thanks to all your listeners. Take care.
Take care. Christy Purcell, 58A, Democrat of the Day. We'll take a break. Wrap up hour one when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Do you really want to? Do you really want to? progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. Yeah, Christy Purcell is fantastic. Holy cow, is she fantastic. What are you going to do? I want to ask you out there. I mean, you hear me what I'm saying. Forget about the cutesy little memes on social media. That's not going to do it. I have been very straightforward. Get three of your friends registered. Find three people that did not vote. Get them registered and get them to the polls on election day. All right? If everyone who's listening to me does that, the Democrats will destroy the Republicans in this state. Absolutely. The DFL will trounce them. Three people. But we've got to, how hard do you want the Democratic majorities in the House and Senate? How much do you want Walz to have another term? How much do you, and like I said, I can agree. Walz, you know, some things, I can. But I want Walz in there as opposed to the clown car brigade that's the Republican Party right now, for goodness sakes. You want Steve Simon? You want Keith Ellison to stay in office? You want to? How about we get rid of the Republican majority in the Senate and we get the DFL in charge there? You're not going to do that by sitting back and expecting someone else to do it for you. Take some time this summer. Get down to 58A. Help Christy Purcell win that district and keep that in DFL hands, because I can tell you what, that is one that the Republicans are going to go after and go after hard. So what are you willing to do to make the blue wave happen this November? We'll take a break. Come on back. Hour number two of the show is up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show on your Tuesday. Matt, Brett, and Patrick here today. 952-946-6205. They have announced two more shows at the State Fair. Now, the Alanis Morissette show that she's coming through with Garbage, now that sounds like a good show. That's different, I believe. That's not State Fair. That's, I think, St. Paul. They're over at the X. They're going to be at the X, I think. But Diana Ross, do not discount Diana Ross. Diana Ross has more hits than you would believe. She can go up there and do 3 hours of music, and she's still not going to get all her hits on in. Gaffigan's coming back. Gaffigan's going to do the State Fair.
Nice.
If I'm Jim Gaffigan, how do you not record that for a special?
I would think that would be perfect for a special, too. Yeah. I mean, you're getting a good crowd out there, good big crowd.
You have to do two of them, right? I think that's how they do it. They have to do two shows so they can, in case they screw up a joke in the one, they have the other show they can kind of cut back and forth. Mm-hmm. And that's the trick of comedy when they're doing – when Burrell was on, he was recording his album, he was doing that over three nights. Pretty much the same set, but in case, you know – You want to kind of make sure you get the best response and stuff like this, right, and the best flow of that show. You need to, but I bet you the State Fair would allow him to do it if they did a State Fair album.
Yeah.
Or State Fair show.
That's unique. I would love that. I would watch that if it's on some streaming service later on Netflix or whatever. Yeah.
Ross, considered one of the most successful recording artists of all time. She is, will perform at the State Fair at 7 p.m. on Saturday, September 3rd. So the 5th will be the last day of the fair then, I guess. Tickets are performance there. Gaffigan is going to be there Tuesday, August 30th, so relatively early. Well, within still the first week. It opens up on the Thursday. So, yeah, you'll be on the Tuesday, August 30th at 7 p.m., the fun tour at the State Fairgrounds. That sounds good. Tickets price range. Okay, so Diana Ross, you can get a ticket. Probably the priciest ticket is $60. Gaffigan's $94. But it's... So you sit really close for the comedian? It's not Gallagher. Who's the guy that smashed the watermelons?
Oh, yeah.
Gallagher?
Yeah, it was Gallagher.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm sitting close so I get watermelon all over me. Unless Gaffigan really has decided to change his act up.
A new and improved Jim Gaffigan at the State Fair, now involving props.
Knowing Gaffigan, what Gaffigan would say is, I was going to smash the food, and then I said, hey, food. So there. You both are you're bigger in sports than I am. I'm not exactly a spring chicken here when it comes to sports either. Gambling. There is, we actually have a bill. It's bipartisan. Stevenson and Garofalo, Stevenson the Democrat, Garofalo the Republican, have introduced this to introduce gambling into Minnesota. The money would go to there would be a surcharge tax. Money would go to youth sports, primarily in the inner city. 40% would go to stopping gambling addiction and working on that. And then and something else, there's some 10% goes to something else. But overall, it's kind of an idea. What is your guys' thoughts on this?
I like the idea that they try to justify it with all the, well, we're going to give money to the inner city sports and we're going to give it to these different organizations. I just always find that kind of humorous, the way they try to justify this. I mean, I guess when it comes to sports gambling, I don't have a huge stance on it. I guess I kind of look at it the same way. Like maybe we look at Sunday liquor sales or legalizing cannabis. It's something maybe you should get done, but we shouldn't really be spending a ton of time on. Move on to more important issues. So that's at least where I kind of sit on the legalizing sports gambling.
Patrick, what's your thoughts?
Well, I'm always in favor of, you know, the Republicans like to say we need new revenues without raising taxes. And I think things like this are always a good avenue to increase revenues. I mean, I know it's kind of has its devoted purposes, but that's kind of what the Republicans say is we need more money, but we need to do it without raising taxes. Well, here you go.
I am of the mindset we don't need to do this. Now, I'll explain why. Your point about Sunday liquor sales. Well, we already had liquor sales in the state, and so we're just doing it on Sunday. And I even made the point back then when we talked about that. I said, well, you know, is it necessarily our job to make sure people can get liquor 24/7, 365? I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily our goal, but I mean, that's the way things are going. Legalized marijuana, we've already got some legalized for the medical treatment. You've already have states that have it legal and stuff like this. So I don't know. I mean, I think that that's more of a comparable thing to the sports gambling. You are going to have more gambling addicts. Period. You're going to have more gambling addicts. But, so the argument I had that they have is, well, they're doing it everywhere else, so we might as well do it here. I don't know if that's necessarily a good argument. I think it's kind of a, yeah, okay, so they're doing it every place else, but, you know, you're going to have more gambling addicts. And no, illegal gambling does not go away. As a matter of fact, it's less, but it's more vicious because the people that are using illegal gambling at that point are people that generally have lost everything and can't, you know, gamble legally. And crime does go up. You legalize gambling, crime does go up. Those statistics are legit. So I just don't quite know. I mean, at the same time, I had someone make a post. I talked about this morning on social media, and someone made a post. He goes, I'm watching these sporting events with my young kids. Do I want every other ad to be gamble, gamble, gamble? It's what all this – and it quite literally is basically just, you know, hot women on the thing going, hey, you want to be the real big winner in your house? Well, you can be like me if you just gamble here on a Titans-Jacksonville game. You know, it's like, really? Yeah, that wouldn't seem to be the case. I don't know if it's necessarily something that – you know, and that's the point is that we're going to get inundated. It's going to be like England. Have you ever been over there, U.K.? You go to the UK, the sports gambling is all illegal over there. It's just everywhere. Just everywhere. And you can't avoid it. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing to all of a sudden open that up to everyone.
Yeah, I personally don't really do any sports gambling. So that's why I guess I don't really have a very strong stance on that. Those are some good points, though, when you talk about the fact that we are going to, yeah, definitely be inundated with those ads. I mean, I can't wait until we get, like, the next stadium named, like, DraftKings Stadium now or something.
It's kind of like how Jack Daniels has put their name on barbecue sauce. They're only doing that just to get the Jack Daniels label out in front of kids. You know, because it's like, if you think about it, when you sit there and say, hey, kids, who wants some Jack Daniels barbecue sauce? You're going to burn in hell for that. Let's just call it what it is. You're doing that. So I guess in Paw Patrol, they're going to have you, you know, doing parlays, I guess. It's the sports.
I don't know. Yeah, I always think it's kind of a dangerous route, though, when we try to regulate rate vices and try to tax vices to get extra government funding. I don't like that idea. So I don't know. I can see both sides of this right now when it comes to the idea of legalizing sports gambling.
There is this mentality that gambling, you know, liquor and liquor has been around forever. Gambling, cigarettes, you know, those are fine. Marijuana, that's the case. But I think it's only a matter of time. I mean, we say to ourselves, oh, well, we wouldn't go with anything more extreme. Well, yeah, you will. Because if you need more money and you don't want to tax people because, heaven forbid, the wealthy people pay their fair share, well, all of a sudden, you know, do you start legalizing prostitution? Do you start legalizing harder drugs? I mean, I think it's kind of one of those things where there's always a downside to vice, and that is just the go-to thing. Now, this case the sports gambling, they're not talking about bringing in, you know, this is going to build the stadium. It's not like the pull tabs, you know, the electronic pull tabs that's going to use to build a stadium. It's not there. So this is just kind of on its own, and there's going to be other things that are funded through it. But I just, you know, is it? Do we really have to always just run to vice? Is that always the case? I will say this. We are some of the only people in town that's probably even having this debate because, my God, if you listen to the sports people in this town, please advertise with me. It's like, Jesus.
Oh, exactly. They're looking at DraftKings and FanDuel to have that money coming on into the wherever they're operating from.
Apparently prostitution's already legal in this state in some ways. I cannot say it like that. All right. Hey, Cooligan, I want to give the Reformer credit because they called out Hepla and his third-party campaign. I didn't bring that up because I knew you were going to be talking to Cooligan here. Patrick Cooligan from the Minnesota Reformer joins you. You're going to be talking about that?
Indeed. We'll be talking about that among, well, two other fairly large topics. One would, of course, be the Minneapolis Teachers Union strike, which just started today. And then the other one is this auditor's report that was released in the city of Minneapolis it hasn't been released yet, but at least one of the council members got the leaked report, basically showing how during the protests in the summer of 2020, Minneapolis Police Department and the mayor's office didn't really have a plan for how to deal with the protests. They just basically decided, we'll wing it. We'll figure it out that way.
I think their official thing was,
that too. Yeah.
Well, seriously. All right. I'll let Patrick Cooligan take it from here. Patrick Cooligan from Minnesota Reformer with Brett here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson here on a Tuesday afternoon. And as usual on Tuesdays, we're joined by J. Patrick Cooligan. He is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. As today, we have no shortage of news to talk about, especially in the city of Minneapolis, as, of course, Minneapolis teachers have announced that they are going on strike, in addition to the fact that we have an independent audit report of Minneapolis's handling of the protests that took place back in 2020 in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. And in addition to that, we're going to touch a little bit on Corey Hepala entering the governor's race as a third-party candidate and what that means. So Patrick joins us now to talk about all of those topics. Hey, how are you doing today?
Good to be here.
Absolutely. So let's start off talking about the independent report that is going to be coming out in regards to the protests of what happened in 2020. Max Nesterak, of course, writes that in an independent audit of Minneapolis's handling of protests and riots following the police murder of George Floyd found city leaders and police ignored emergency plans in place, instead making decisions on the fly. The report says the MPD does not adhere to the principles of the ICS, which stands for Incident Command System, but rather addresses emergencies and crises with an ad hoc command structure. And Mayor Jacobs Frey's office did not ensure the appropriate implementation of the emergency operations plan. So, Patrick, even though we don't have this full report quite yet, even in this little preview that we were able to obtain, this certainly does not paint Mayor Jacob Frey or the MPD in a good light, considering what happened back in the summer of 2020.
Right. I think that, the real question is, why wasn't this made available before the city elections in November? I think voters should have had access to this information, and I think it's unfortunate that they didn't. I think I would call this, what we know so far, and I'll be upfront, I haven't read the report. I've only been getting reports from our reporter, Max Nesterak. But it sounds shocking on the one hand, but not that surprising, because I think if you witness those events in May and June of 2020, what you saw was what looked like a chaotic response. And certainly that's what the report would indicate, as you mentioned, an ad hoc response. There's sort of a kind way of putting it in a foreign tongue. It does not cast a good light on the city, or the police department. And I also think it's interesting the way that this has been, released. The council members, were only able to review two physical copies of the draft versions of this report. They didn't have a digital copy of this. They had to go in and review it in person. And clearly, city leadership, the mayor and his allies, the council president and vice president, just didn't want this leaking. And it suggests that they're really, really hyper-focused on how they are going to be perceived and how the report was going to be perceived and not on the actual findings. So a lot to be concerned about here.
Yeah, and really what this does, it paints the Minneapolis Police Department again as kind of being more incompetent, which at least me personally speaking, that seems to be the bigger issue that they're having right now when we talk about conversations with the police department, is that they appear overall very ineffective when you consider that they're having these massive protests back in the summer of 2020 and they're largely just making decisions on the fly. That certainly is not very good at all. And I want to back up to another point. You talked about how it would have been nice to have at least part of this report in time for, well, the elections that we had in Minneapolis last year. Why were we having such a tough time getting access to this report? I know you were mentioning that city council members were having trouble getting the report. Members of the media, including you guys at the Reformer, were having trouble. What were the excuses in terms of why we weren't able to get this information out publicly? Because this would have, I think, played a much bigger role, I'm guessing, during last year's elections in Minneapolis.
Well, that was always the case when they signed the contract. It was that they would not be finished and available until after the election. So that decision was a long time in the works. Obviously the mayor had a very good reason to not have this out in the public before the election. As far as what's happening just in the last few days, once we became aware of the report, as far as I'm concerned, that's a public document. We should have had access to it. The council vice president, Linnea Tomasano, she said that it was, they're just following the usual process, that it was only that they were only seeing a confidential draft report, not yet finalized. And so, they did not have the ability to turn it over, until the council had accepted it. Be that as it may, it's almost 2 years later and, I don't know why it would take so long to find out, have these findings in our hands.
Yeah, we'll of course get the full report at least eventually later on when they report to the Minneapolis City Council. But for now, we're only kind of getting bits and pieces of it. You can read more about that over at MinnesotaReformer.com. Well, the other big story today has to do with teacher strikes. And in the city of St. Paul, well, their teachers were able to reach an agreement with the school district to avoid a strike. But in Minneapolis, that's not the case, as Minneapolis teachers are going on strike for the first time in over 50 years, as the Minneapolis Teachers Union is seeking greater support services for student mental health, smaller class sizes, and pay raises, especially for educational support staff. While the Minneapolis School District says they simply don't have the money. Patrick, tell us a little bit more about this strike and what you're hearing so far.
Yeah, the school district has a structural deficit, and what I mean by that is it's not due to any the economic cycle or recession or anything like that. They just have lost enrollment. When they lose enrollment, they lose state money. And so they're running a deficit already, and they're projecting another bigger one next year. And the teachers are asking for a 20% increase, which is quite significant. And teachers have been through the last couple of years. I think a lot of people certainly sympathize with their demands. And as you noted, they're also wanting the paraprofessionals, who are sort of teacher assistants, they apparently their starting salary is $24,000, and they want to go to $35,000, which would be certainly much more livable in the city of Minneapolis. And then, as you mentioned, kids are having all kinds of mental health problems, and so they want more help in every single school building. So I don't know how this plays out, because all of that's going to cost a significant amount of money, and the district just doesn't have it. Certainly, people are calling on the legislature to help out. The state of Minnesota is sitting on a significant surplus, but we're not going to see that out of the Senate Republicans, who have no interest in helping out the Minneapolis school district or its teachers.
And, of course, I imagine the longer the strike goes on makes it more likely that an agreement is eventually reached. So it kind of is a matter of which side ends up blinking first in this case and who makes some moves at the bargaining table.
Yeah, I mean, this is a real crisis for parents and students. And so I certainly hope that they can come to some agreement. They did manage to come to an agreement in St. Paul, where they were on the verge of striking, but they came to an agreement last night.
I want to turn our attention to one more topic, and this has to do with a column you wrote that has to do with, well, Corey Heppala entering the governor's race as a third-party candidate. The title of the column is, "Before You Turn Us Into Wisconsin, Drop Your Vanity Campaign." Now, as you write, Minnesota certainly does have a history of electing third-party candidates. When we look at the fact that Jesse Ventura, of course, won the governor's race back in 1998, we had a very active independence party for a few years. Now we, of course, have the very active legalized cannabis parties, which we actually have two of those for some reason. So we do have a history of supporting third parties in Minnesota, but I think at least when we look at that comparison to Jesse Ventura, he had more of a unique appeal, especially with name recognition and his marketing campaign. And when we look at Corey Heppala, he is a former personality on WCCO radio, but I don't think he quite has that same sort of profile as like a Jesse Ventura had back in 1998. So I think he's going to face a much bigger uphill battle in terms of trying to gain any traction in the governor's race.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I should be embarrassed to admit this, but I definitely had to Google him when the name started to get tossed around as for somebody running for governor. I think his name recognition is, I'm sure it's less than 5% of the Minnesota public. And he doesn't have $10 million in the bank or anybody willing to bankroll him. So, you know, it's just a mystery why exactly he's running. And he hasn't staked out any policy positions to speak of. He says he voted for Tim Walz and for Joe Biden. So I don't really understand what the point of it all is. The issue is that we're at a key moment in the history of the state and the history of the nation. We're just coming off a moment when the former president tried to essentially nullify the election he lost. We could very well wind up with an all-Republican legislature next year. And so this little campaign that he's running could actually be really damaging because let's say that he were to appeal to 2-4% of, you know, maybe highly educated suburban centrists who you know, want to register their protest against Governor Tim Walz, but they're not really willing to go with the Republican. And that winds up throwing the election to the Republican candidate for governor. So, you know, unless he is committed, is okay with the state going in that direction, then he ought to reconsider.
And going back to the headline you wrote, which I think sums it up, "Before You Turn Us Into Wisconsin, Drop Your Vanity Campaign," it's important to point out because if we go back to even 2010, Minnesota was very close to becoming a state like Wisconsin, where back during that 2010 election cycle, Republicans were able to flip both houses of the state legislature, and they came very close to winning the governor's race. Now, it was Mark Dayton who ended up defeating Tom Emmer by, I believe, a couple thousand votes. But if a couple thousand votes have gone the other way, Minnesota very likely would be a red state and looking a lot like Wisconsin. And that very easily could have happened if we had a stronger third-party candidate in 2010. And I think, as you write, that very easily could happen in 2022 if you get a spoiler candidate and a potential red wave. That could put Minnesota in a very different situation of having, well, a Republican trifecta in our state, which I don't think we've ever had in the history of Minnesota. So third parties, I know the deck is generally stacked against them, but then again, on the other hand, when you look at third parties, they do oftentimes play spoilers, since typically they do siphon votes from one party more than the other, whether it's Democrats or Republicans. And just given what you talked about with Heppala saying he voted for Tim Walz and did you say it was Tim Walz and Joe Biden he voted for in 2000?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, he would likely siphon more votes from Democrats than Republicans. So, in essence, he's pretty much just a spoiler, isn't he?
That's the only role he can play.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly.
I mean, in my mind. And so then, you know, you basically are just handing the election over. And why do you want to do that? Do you want to make the state a trifecta Republican state? And the first thing they're going to do, I would think, would be to try to break some of the big public sector unions. That's exactly what they did in Wisconsin, because that's such a source of Democratic money and power. And once you break those unions, now look at Wisconsin. I mean, you know, they have had some good elections, but the state has definitely gone in a different direction than Minnesota since 2010, as you pointed out. And Mark Dayton, I mean, his victory was very narrow. So we could be looking at that situation again.
And like I said, if someone wants to run as a third-party candidate, by all means, go for it and do it. But just realize the consequences of what might happen. I don't know, you've covered politics for a while, Patrick, and have probably had a chance to speak to third-party candidates. What exactly is the appeal to run, especially when, for the most part, they probably have no chance to win? Could it be that maybe they do have some idea where they do have a path to victory, or is it just a way to get name recognition? I get why you might want to run as a third party, but oftentimes it's easy to underestimate the consequences of actually launching that third party run.
There's a history of these other alternative parties really bringing ideas into the mainstream, and I think we could see that with the two marijuana legalization parties, that they clearly have. I think that's what they're trying to do, and they want to force one or both parties to sort of co-opt their message, and that's fine. In fact, I think that's healthy. But what this campaign is about is, this sort of bromides about no more division and bringing everybody together. Well, that's just phony, and it just ignores the fact that we have division for real reasons, real substantial reasons that have to do with the future of the state and the future of the country. And I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. And again, I mean, what is the point of running if you don't have any actually concrete ideas about what you do with the office?
Yeah, and that's another good point, too, where you can say, well, I want to appeal to both sides, but we don't really have a whole lot in terms of any policy positions yet for Corey Heppala. You can read Patrick Coulican's article, or excuse me, column about that over at MinnesotaReformer.com. Again, the title is, Before You Turn Us Into Wisconsin, Drop Your Vanity Campaign. Well, we are just about out of time for our conversation today. We have been speaking with Patrick Coulican, editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Patrick, as always, thanks for the time today. Appreciate you joining me.
Great to be here.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I did not see this, that apparently Jensen has announced that Matt Burke, the former Vikings player, is going to be his lieutenant governor running mate. Whew. Wow. Yeah, they Super Bowl champion, not Vikings Super Bowl champion, though. It's like, was it Baltimore? Was he Baltimore or the Ravens on that one?
Yeah, that would be my assumption.
Yeah, if you want to ruin his brand by letting everyone know about who exactly he is, but good luck. I got to tell you right now, if Burke really hasn't done this, and apparently KSTP in town reported that it did, that he did accept it. How is Scott Jensen not the Republican nominee? Also, Minnesota Reformer, that once again, that is an exceptional calling out Corey Heppala, because, dude, you clearly, and I said this the day you announced, one, you either have no idea what the governor does, two, you really are delusional about your abilities. I can say this as a radio guy, dude. And once again, I'm a business major from William Penn. I was in the U.S. military. I drink politics constantly. I understand how the system works. I understand how the state works. I understand the nuances of this all. I know a lot about the state of Minnesota. I love this state to my core. I am in no way qualified to be the governor of the state of Minnesota. Not in a million freaking years. That's called reality. And just because a few of your fans said, you know what you should do? Oh, my God. I mean, God, if amazing if you did this. Oh, my God. You should be governor. Oh, my God. Oh, my God, man. It comes with a house. You want to live in the house. It's going to be awesome. We're going to party. It's going to get cool. Dude, no. Or else you're a Republican plant. That's number three. You could be a Republican plant. This is a vanity project. It seems like this is just a vanity project for him. Julie is in Minneapolis, 952-946-6205. Hiya, Julie.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I find it very curious that Corey Hepler said in his private life, he votes for Democrats. I have listened to this man on and off for 4 years. He's been on WCCO, the morning show. He has never espoused an opinion that was not Republican. Never. So here's my quick question. I'm just curious, down the road now, is there any way for an ordinary person or a reporter, can you research who gives a third-party candidate money, where they get their money from?
Sure, I think you can, yeah.
So I'll hang up and listen.
Well, and Julie, here's the deal, is that, you know, it's not the first time I've heard that. That this guy, when he's on the air, sure doesn't sound like a Democrat or someone who agrees with the Democrats. And it's not a surprise. I mean, if you look at the demographics behind that radio station, they're kind of trying to appeal to the elderly, you know, audience, which generally skews Trump. So that doesn't surprise me at all. But it's a lot like when Michelle Tafoya comes on out and she goes, I'm a middle of the roader. And then she says, I'm a libertarian. I'm like, okay, middle of the roader and libertarian are not two things you can use in the same sentence. So it's a lot of trying to convince people. I voted for Donald Trump. I mean, I voted for Joe Biden. You don't sound like you're a Biden supporter from all this. I mean, like I said, I've gotten inundated with people like, did you hear when he talked about this? Did you hear when he talked about this? I'm like, No, I don't. I didn't even know who this dude was. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm going to be dead honest with you. I think I'd heard of him once or twice, but I was like, who? And I had to be reminded exactly who he was. So. I got good news. How about some good news? Good. The Smile File is here. How about that? The Smile File. Guilty on all charges. This is Guy Reffitt of Texas. This is the first 1-6 traitor, bastard, insurrectionist who went to said, I'm going to go to trial and I'm going to win. Ah, 4 hours. 4 hours. 4 hours it took them to basically come back guilty, 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 guilty across the board. Guilty of transporting a firearm in furtherance of civil disorder. Guilty of entering with a firearm. Guilty of obstructing officers. Guilty of all charges. And this is the guy whose son actually was so concerned about him, he actually went to the FBI tip line. And he had threatened his kids. He threatened his own kids to kill his own kids, if they dared, you know, talk about it. Well, he is guilty. And this is the first one. It took 4 hours. I don't understand what these 1-6 insurrectionist traitor bastards, I don't know what they've got in regards to a defense. I don't know what they think they've got. But we've got a lot of video, and a lot of it was from you proudly saying, I'm toppling democracy today. It's your videos. And all of a sudden you're like, I didn't mean it. And that's what your entire defense is. If you're in a trial, if you're in a courtroom and you've got a jury there, you're a oopsie, I didn't mean it like that, is not a defense. Is not a defense. Guilty on all counts. What's hilarious is his delusional wife is out there telling everyone who is still going to go to trial that, you know, hey, stay with your trial. Don't plead out. Stay with your trial. Dude. If I'm a 1-6 insurrectionist, traitorous bastard, and I saw this, it took them 4 hours to find him guilty. 4 hours. On three charges. That's like, all right, we got Matlock coming up here in a few hours here. So let's wrap this up really quick here, okay? I don't even think we need subs for lunch. I think we're going to be getting this done. Guilty, 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 and done. All right, where do I sign? Good. All right, let's go back to the courtroom. And Matlock. Dude, if you are a 1-6 insurrectionist, traitorous bastard, and you are saying to yourself, I'm going to take this to court, and I'm going to let the jury decide. Dude, you are going to lose. You are going to lose. And by the way, Scott McFarlane, who is the exceptional journalist, I think he's CBS News, he has been covering the 1-6 insurrectionists. His coverage of this, he said, the judge really, in the instructions to the jury, sort of said, the defense doesn't really have to prove anything. This is all on the prosecution. And because the defense, I think what the judge was trying to do was trying to help the defendant, because the defendant really didn't even put up a case. He just sort of argued, oh, this was, I didn't mean it like this. And yeah, the judge comes on out and says, you know, it's 100% on the prosecution. The prosecution has to prove their point. And it's still 4 hours, 4 hours. Three charges took 4 hours. Wow. If I am one of you insurrectionist, traitorous bastards, I am like, what's the plea deal? I'll take it now. Because I can tell you right now, this guy, when the sentencing happens in June, when this guy gets sentenced, everyone's going to be like, oh my God, he's going to go to jail for 6 years, 5 years, 6 years. And they're going to be like, holy, okay, no, 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 no. I don't want to be in jail for another 5-6 years. I'll take 8 months and get out of here. But I guarantee you this, if at this point, anyone that wanted to go to trial, that did not go to trial, and, you know, basically is trying to weasel their way out of it now, I think that any plea deal you have with them has to include jail time. Has to include jail time. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. All right, let's do the Minnesota coronavirus update for today. Tuesday's COVID-19 update from the Minnesota Department of Health includes 1,457 newly reported cases, 20 newly reported deaths, including a person aged 20 to 24 years old from Anoka County. The state's COVID-19 death toll now is 12,221. So once again, this is a 72-hour period. So if you're wondering why 14.57 seemed higher than usual, well, that's basically divided by three. So it's a little less than 500 cases per day on average there. 20 newly reported deaths, that's still a lot of people dying. I actually talked to someone today, a friend of mine. We were over at the Y, and I'm working out, and I said, you know, 20 people died. You know, I think, what was it, 14 people died yesterday? 14 people died yesterday. He goes, in the country? I said, no, just in Minnesota. He goes, really? I said, yeah, every single day. 20 people died. 20 human beings died. 20. Including a person aged 20 to 24. Remember, God, how many lies did the Trump people scream? The only people that die are old people. This is going to be gone in 3 weeks. No one young dies. And by the way, I've got an update on something here, courtesy of our good friend, Dr. Joe Eastman, here in just a second, that it's just going to be like, holy God. Here's the positive news. The Minnesota test positivity rate on the 7-day rolling average through February 28th is 4.0%, down once again, having been as high as the mid-20s in January. Once again, if you're below 5, community spread, widespread community spread has actually gone down pretty much. So that's pretty good there. Still, you want to be careful, though. Through March 7th, the number of people with COVID-19 hospitalized in Minnesota was 366, down from 418 reported on March 4th. Of those hospitalized, 44 people are in intensive care, down from 57. 322 are in non-ICU care, down from 361. That's the fewest ICU COVID patients since there were 44 on July 25th. It's the fewest non-ICU patients since there were 319 on August 16th. As of March 6th, the state reported that 3,883,726 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 3,668,047 people have completed the vaccine series. The state has administered 2,160,448 third-dose booster shots. Total number of people in Minnesota who have been diagnosed with COVID, 1,420,149. This is Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. This is Dr. Joe Eastman, our model expert that talks about COVID. He sent this to me. I'm going to just read this here. Adult COVID-19 survivors, even those with mild illnesses who underwent scans, showed changes in brain structure beyond that expected from normal aging, including in the areas tied to smell and memory, according to a UK study published yesterday in Nature. University of Oxford investigators administered cognitive tests to and scanned the brains of 765 visitors to the UK Biobank Imaging Centers two times, an average of 38 months apart. In the 785 participants, 401 were diagnosed as having COVID-19 between their scans from March 2020 to April 2021. The remaining 384 participants were age and sex match controls. Patients were aged 51 to 81 years. 15 COVID-19 patients were hospitalized and two received critical care. Relatives to their non-hospitalized peers, hospitalized patients were on average older and had high blood pressure and weight, were more likely to be diabetes and be men. Although the previous research suggests that COVID-19 may cause brain abnormalities and cognitive dysfunction, most studies have involved hospitalized patients with severe illness and have been limited to post-COVID imaging data. So this is different. Among the COVID-19 survivors, this is just basically people that got COVID, even mild cases of COVID, not hospitalized cases, that the brain is changing. This next, you know, brain tissue damage, whole brain shrinkage. Okay, get freaking vaccinated, will you? Get vaccinated. Listen to this. Whole brain shrinkage, even with mild cases of COVID. Holy God. COVID-19 survivors, an average of 141 days elapsed between diagnosis and the second brain scan, revealed evidence of brain tissue damage in areas linked with olfactory cortex tied to the smell area, a reduction of the whole brain volume, and an increase in cerebrospinal fluid volume. Cognitive decline was also evident between the two scans, as shown by atrophy of the cerebellum. A control analysis of the patients of the non-COVID pneumonia showed that these brain changes were specific to COVID-19 rather than the generic effects of a respiratory disease. So once again, you've got people who had a brain scan. They brought them back in, kept a control group that didn't get COVID, had a group that did get COVID, checked the brains, and even in mild cases, there was dramatic brain changes. Holy God. I'm sure some Republican right now is going, but bleach. I would love to hear how you guys think that you're going to regrow brain tissue. That how you're going to reverse that whole brain shrinkage. Wow. The long-term effects of COVID, we're not even beginning to understand them. And this is the scariest part of all, is that, I mean, it's stuff like this. Stuff like this is coming to light now. Brain shrinkage, brain tissue damage. Just, cerebellum and the olfactory cortex. Don't tell me, go get freaking vaccinated. Go get vaccinated. I know this is going to be a reach by these liberals, but I don't want you to have whole brain shrinkage. Dear Lord, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. This is once again a study. University of Minnesota's got it in. It's the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. I'll post it online a little bit later on. You can read it for yourself. Wow, it is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I'd be remiss if we did not mention the big local story today. Minneapolis teachers and educational support professionals began picketing outside of schools at 7:30 a.m. on Tuesday, marking the city's district's first teacher strike since 1970. The classes will be canceled for the duration of the strike. The strike has left working families scrambling to figure out what to do with their kids. It's a familiar quandary for Minneapolis parents who have endured 2 years of pandemic upheaval. Union leaders announced the walkout on Monday evening, saying they have been unable to reach an agreement with the Minneapolis Public Schools. St. Paul's schools, though, are in session as the district reached a tentative agreement with the St. Paul Federation of Teachers late on Monday. That agreement for a two-year contract includes higher wages, including for educational assistants, as well as class size caps, increased mental health supports, one-time payments for educators, the union said. The Minneapolis union has pushed for a settlement on many of those same issues, including class size caps and mental health supports. We're on strike for safe and stable schools and a systemic change, said Greta Callahan, president of the teacher chapter of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers, and on Tuesday morning's news conference to Justice Page Middle School in South Minneapolis. She said she and other local, national, and teacher union leaders spoke as dozens of educators chanted and held picket signs nearby. We're ready to get back to the table. We want to be this the shortest strike possible. The reality is that teachers have been screwed over. Now, I have heard from more freaking far rightos who are either trying to push, you know, talking points that they are being told to push, or else they're just ignorant morons who will argue, whose the argument is, their argument is, why are we paying teachers this much? They don't deserve anything. All teachers in Minneapolis get paid $100,000 a year. They want another $50,000. That's just unreasonable. I mean, just pulling it out of their butt. And they're just making crap up, because this is, we are in the age of the rise of the worker again. That's where we're at right now in America. We've had 40 years of conservative employment policy, and we've had 40 years of Republicans saying, we're not going to raise wages. We're just going to give a lot of money to wealthy people. And maybe if they're benevolent, they'll let it trickle on down. And it never trickles down. Or it rarely trickles down. Most of these guys have become, you know, 5 or 6 times as more wealthy as they ever were. And they have no intention of giving you a cut of that pie. None whatsoever. And so when all of a sudden people are like, I'm tired of working for $10, $12, $15 an hour as hard as I am, I want actually a livable wage, that's when all these people are like, hey, you lazy people don't want to work. No. These are not lazy people. These are people that have been abused by 40 years of conservative employment policy. And the reality is these teachers are underpaid. They're underappreciated. They need to get much more money because of the amount of work they do. How many unfunded mandates have Republicans put on schools? My God. They're trying to help the kids with mental health issues. They're trying to keep class sizes minimal. These are not exactly people that are only looking out for themselves. They are looking out for the betterment of the kids that they have been tasked to educate. And my God, they do a brilliant job. I am 100% behind the Minnesota Teachers Union and this strike, because it's about damn time these people got paid what they deserve. And going in there and being tasked by administration to basically do jobs that you've not been hired in, that are basically 20 to 30 times more or 30 hours more work per week while getting no extra salary, by getting no raises, that's unacceptable. Pay the teachers. They are saints. And you sure as heck demanded them to be in those school classrooms when COVID was out there. And we should remember, too, how many teachers got sick and died of COVID. They deserve the benefits. Give them to them. Native Roots Radio is up next. We're back tomorrow. Till then, see ya.